discussions of the meaning of Marxism for the Christian faith. Yesterday, Ralph Ahlers talked about the way in which he saw the meaning of Marxism and the problems with Marxism and the way in which it challenged the Christian faith. And today, Bob Benny, who's with the Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago in social ethics, will talk about the meaning of Marxism for the Christian faith.
Right. The Christian Marxist dialogue is not one of my specialties, but it's almost impossible to stay out of the fray or the discussion if you're teaching in a school like I'm teaching. And what adds kind of the spice to the pie is that we have a Jesuit school of theology connected with our school, taking courses in the same space that we do. So we have many Jesuit students in courses. And over the years, I've been drawn into the Christian Marxist debate simply by teaching courses on social ethics and having Jesuit students there. I'm interested in Christian ethics' relation to economic theory, but I haven't made any specialty of Marxist economic thought. But as I say, you can't avoid the discussion, particularly if you... I give a course on Christianity and capitalism in the fall quarter, and that's loaded with Jesuit students, and the debate really goes on hot and heavy, because many of them are very much into a Marxist economic interpretation. So the argument that I'm going to lay out for you here has been picked up not only from reading, but from the discussions with those Jesuit students, and some Protestant students too. And just to existentialize it a little bit, as I said yesterday, they send their students to Latin America for extended periods of time. And as all of us know, Latin America is a heavily Roman Catholic continent. But there's ferment in every one of those countries, terrific ferment. Large numbers of poor people, a small level of elite level of higher class people, most of the land in the hands of those upper class people, a heavy military establishment, and a terrific turbulence from below among the poor. And these guys go to Latin America, spend 2 or 3 years generally out in the bush somewhere with the poor. And they know that they're caught between terrific, powerful forces between those who hold power, which is generally right-wing, aristocratic, military governments, and the left-wing, who purports at least to stand on behalf of the poor in peasant revolutions of various sorts, and you get a terrific polarization. So when you're put into that kind of grinder, you've got to come up with some sort of interpretation of what's going on. You just have to try to sort it out and understand for yourself what's happening. And by far the most persuasive to them, persuasive interpretation of what's happening, as well as a vision for what can happen in the future, is a modified or modern Marxist interpretation of what's going on. And they come back with that interpretation fully internalized and believing strongly in it. And they constantly invite Latin American theologians to help them work out the interrelation of the Christian faith to Marxism. And so this, while for us it's an interesting discussion, this is really no intellectual gain for them. They're working out their ministry in a very turbulent situation. So they're very, very deeply involved in it. Now, what I want to do is to describe the argument and the interpretation that they gain from Marxism that's very persuasive to them. And then, at the very end, say a few words about how they've related their Christian faith, the Christian revelation, to that Marxist analysis and Marxist prescription for the future. In order to do that, I have to step back and lay out a few fundamental elements of the Marxist argument. And so I want to spend a couple of minutes on that and show how it's applied In the modern situation, to interpret the Latin American situation, particularly in relation to North America. As was mentioned yesterday, the Marxist analysis believes that the change in the economic substratum of life is the fundamental change. So you get a change in the means of production that will change social relationships, change class relationships. That in turn changes thought. And thought is generally viewed as simply a reflection of one's class position, and one's class position is a reflection of economic change or economic substratum. So economics changes, social classes, social relations change, and then finally thought changes. And that's kind of the chain of causation from a Marxist point of view. Well, they believe that inherent in the nature of history itself, the economic substratum will change dialectically until finally there's a revolution and a hope for a kind of a paradise in the end. So, and as I said yesterday, there's this kind of a heretical Christian view of history, taking the Christian view for fulfillment that for many ages was looked upon in an otherworldly fashion, and they've taken that hope for fulfillment and they put it into history and argue that it's going to happen in history and it's necessary. That there's a logic in economic life itself that'll drive toward that goal of fulfillment. And so as the Christian story, you know, they've got a Marxist version of it. There's a kind of idea of paradise before the fall, kind of primitive communism, whereas Rolf talked about it yesterday, there's a crude way that the individual expresses himself or herself in the world and is unified with his or her work or labor. So there's the peasant that plants something, sees it through, and there's a creative relationship between the peasant and his work. There are builders that build something and externalize themselves into that product. And it's kind of dreaming innocence. It's the paradise before the fall, where everyone is doing their things. It's kind of primitive communism. But the big problem with the paradise is that nature dominates man. The natural elements weigh upon him. He ekes a bare existence out of the earth, short-lived, violent, racked by sickness, storms, things like that. There's a total domination of man by nature. Okay, but the dialectic then is set off. There's the fall. And the fall is the fall into private property and the division of labor. And remember, this is all necessary. This has to happen. Someone divides up the tasks of producing things. And someone gains possession of the land, tools, the means of producing things. That's the capitalist class who gains private ownership. That's the capitalist. And he divides up the labor, which makes things more productive, you see. You can produce more, it's more efficient. So there's a division of labor, private ownership of property, and then you begin to get classes. You get the laboring classes who contribute their labor to the productive process. But the capitalist up here owns the means of production. He owns the land, the tools. Later on in the industrial age, he owns the factories, all the machinery. He owns the means of production, and he controls what it is that's going to be produced. Controls the product. He disposes of the product as he wishes. The capitalist sells it for this and that, decides when it should be changed, etc. So this is what Rolf called alienation yesterday. Instead of the laborer choosing what he will produce and externalizing himself into the product, as some of you saw Rich Kemmerer this morning, the creative process of doing that painting, in which he was expressing himself into that canvas, is kind of the ideal image you might have in mind as to what it means to express oneself into the world. So after the fall into private property, the laborer just contributes his labor. He doesn't have any control over the means of production, over the product. He's alienated from it. It's just taken from him. His labor is wrenched from him for a small amount of money, and the process goes on that way. The capitalist is also alienated from the laborer and from the product, too, because he doesn't produce the product in any direct sense. Well, this is based upon, in technical economic language, a labor theory of value, that only labor can produce something of value. Technology doesn't produce anything of value, but it's only labor. So, whenever the capitalist makes money and becomes wealthy and builds up his capital, it's dependent upon him wrenching more and more surplus labor from the laborer. He wrenches more and more out of the laborer and pays him as little as possible. And as he grows wealthy and builds up his capital and the means of production and grows wealthy, he's expropriating from the laborer that surplus value and growing rich off of it. There's an expropriation here. So he gains wealth, gets bigger, while the laborer is more and more is taken from the laborer. And he has, again, no relation to his product. So it's squeezing it out. Now, the rest of the story is that there are a lot of capitalists, of course, and there's competition between the capitalists to produce more for less. And now that competition, as we all know, drives the capitalist to become more efficient, but it also drives him to wrench more and more out of the laborer, expropriate more and more labor value, surplus value from the laborer. And so competition takes place among the capitalists, and they begin to kill each other off. It's who is most efficient, they win out. And so you get warfare, a competitive warfare among capitalists. And what happens to those capitalists who fail? They begin to fall back into the proletariat. There's a growing pool of people who have no control over their product, are just, their labor is wrenched from them. And the capitalist grows fat off them, but he's in competition with other capitalists, and people fail and fall back into this proletariat army, this industrial army that grows larger and larger and larger. The capitalist becomes fewer, but huge things. And of course, when a capitalist falls, tremendous numbers of people then fall back into this proletarian pool. Well, as that pool grows larger and larger, the capitalists grow fewer and bigger at the top, but fewer, and the pool expands and expands. Finally, I've gone through a whole long story very briefly and simply. Finally, the conditions are ripe for revolution because there's so many people expropriated in misery, frustration, nothing to lose. You have nothing to lose but the chains of bondage. And so that's the time when the revolution takes place, an explosion. All of this is a necessary dialectic that has to take place. There's an explosion. What happens is private property is abolished. The proletariat down here, since it has no economic self-interest, in some sense is able then to take over things, and you get the dictatorship of the proletariat, get the withering away of the state, and you get the reunification in the paradisical vision, the reunification of the worker with his product. Only after all this dialectic has taken place, the revolution has occurred, it's no longer nature dominating man, it's man dominating nature, but fully expressing himself in the product and reunified with the product as he was a long time ago, only this time he's dominated nature. Well, that's the scenario in a very brief classical sense of the Marxist interpretation. And Marx wrote about German society, he wrote about British society, about American society, and that kind of analysis was extremely persuasive to people. This was before the labor movements, in which organization had wrenched concessions out of the industrial world, and this was a very persuasive interpretation for thousands of people. So the communist parties following Marx, some of the socialist parties, fully expected this scenario to take place in Western society. In Germany, first of all, then in Britain, Netherlands, United States. Didn't happen. Didn't happen. 1848. They thought it was going to happen. They thought it was going to happen many, many times. But what happened? The communist revolutions took place in Russia, a backward agricultural state without any industrial capacity. It took place in China, backward agricultural country without industrial capacity. It took place in, it's taking place in Cuba, another agricultural country, Angola, Vietnam, none of which are industrial countries. The scenario interpretation was still supposed to take place in industrialized countries. And none of that happened. It took place somewhere else in agricultural countries. And then it's been imposed upon many other countries. But basically, a long-standing surprise. It worked in places where it wasn't supposed to work. Revolutions took place. Now, how do you interpret that? How do you make sense of this? Here's this neat interpretation that isn't working where it's supposed to work, but it's working other places. And what the contemporary, at least from a Latin American point of view, the contemporary argument is that this drama that was supposed to be played out within Western industrial nations, Germany, United States, Great Britain, that drama that's supposed to be played out within a nation is being played out on a world scale, particularly in the relations between the United States and Latin America. That the little tiny drama that's supposed to be within a country is now being played out on a world scale. And the image you get is this vast external proletariat, the third world, poor and miserable, surrounding an affluent capitalist group of capitalist countries. And that instead of all these gradations, these classes happening within one society, it's happening in the world. So you get the Western European American axis being the capitalist owners of the means of production, who have control over what is produced, own the means of production, and they send out their tentacles to Canada. They send out a whole bunch of tentacles to kind of an octopus image here. My art isn't that great. All kinds of tentacles into the underdeveloped parts of the world, into Asia, into Latin America, many, many of them in Latin America, many in Asia, into Canada, into Africa. They want to get into Africa, but the tentacles keep getting clipped off. And what's happening is that we are the capitalist organization of the world. We control the means of production. We do it through transcontinental businesses. We control the economic life of Latin America, of much of Asia. We try to do it in Africa. We do it in Canada. All of these countries of the third world are in a relationship of dependence. It's dependent capitalism that they're experiencing. And what we do is we control their economic life, get their products from them cheaply, expropriate their labor, and not only raw products, but some products of their hands we take from them and use them, buy them cheap for our own affluence, sell back to them very expensive stuff. And for every dollar that we put into their countries, we take $3 out. That's one of the rough equations that are used. So the transnational corporation is our instrument of sending these tentacles out to bleed white the rest of the country, and we draw in their wealth. That's the expropriation of the rest of the world by the capitalist nations. And their poor people get poorer, and then, but we've got a neat alliance with the top segment of their country, with the old aristocratic elite. They know where their bread is buttered, so they go with us. And the military is very important, because the military makes connections with us, and they see to it that our economic enterprise is not disrupted. Now, this is the scenario taking place. Meanwhile, you get a growing pool of very, very poor people, frustrated, angry, alienated, in great misery, and the conditions of explosion begin to up. So what you've got in Latin America, according to this Marxist analysis, is dependent capitalism, an external proletariat, which the capitalist nations, foremost among them the United States, in full control and creating this external proletariat that will revolt, will overturn the capitalist system. Now, this is the persuasive analysis that young students, some of Marx are young, the Jesuits are 35 by the time they finish their education, they come back. This is the vision of the world. They're looking for an interpretation of what's going on, and this is by far the most persuasive, dominating interpretation of what's happening economically in their world, in Latin America, particularly in relation to North America. And many, many segments of the Latin American society buy into this interpretation. Our congregation sponsored a Chilean family that was imprisoned by the military junta. And this fellow had not done really nothing illegal and put into jail for 3 years and exiled permanently. But when you hear him talk, it's very similar to what I've said. He's a believing Christian, and this interpretation, you can just follow it step by step as he lays it out. Now, the Catholics, and this is really a Catholic dialogue and wrestling, argue that this is not necessarily atheistic. You don't have to be atheistic to accept the Marxist analysis and even a lot of the Marxist vision of what will come. But for them, it illuminates the relations between the United States and Latin America, and they use it. They think it's by far the most accurate and penetrating analysis. Now, just in a final few words, how are they relating Christianity and Marxism in this Latin American situation? Well, there's always been within the Latin American, the Roman Catholic tradition, a drive for the synthesis of culture, the synthesis of a society. And the medieval synthesis is still, in some ways, a lingering ideal for Catholics, in which, just to diagram it, culture, politics, economics raises human life to a certain level, to the fully natural level. And then the Christian revelation and the grace operating through the church takes you the second flight up to the beatific vision, to human fulfillment. And so the Christian revelation stands above politics, economics, and social life, but it's very, politics, economics, and social life is highly valued and as preparation for the fulfillment, for the completion of human nature. The church, Christian revelation completes it, but it's very important that you have an adequate society to get you that first step. Now, in the medieval times, it was Aristotelian philosophy and medieval culture, but particularly an Aristotelian view of politics, economics, and society. And St. Thomas took the Christian revelation and integrated, synthesized that Aristotelian philosophy with the Christian revelation. You have this beautiful architectonic whole in the Middle Ages, a beautiful thing to read about. and to dream of, a time when the world fit together. Well, that's still a driving Roman Catholic motif, I believe. And as I said yesterday, what's happening with Marxism is that Marxism is becoming the social philosophy, social political economic philosophy that provides that first step, provides bringing the human up to the fully natural level, and then the church will bring it up to fulfillment. And so what I think, as Camara, the bishop, a Brazilian bishop, said, is that Catholics are doing with Marx what St. Thomas did with Aristotle, is really going on very seriously in Roman Catholic theological reflection. So Marxism becomes the tool of analysis. What's happening gives social and political and economic ideas of what the future should be, and that's synthesized with Christianity so that the two fit together. And there's a dialogue, a powerful dialogue going on, a criticism of Marxism, but Marxism also critiquing Christianity. And it's a serious dialogue. And the Catholic drive is toward that kind of one church, one state, one social political philosophy, a unified whole. And of course, Latin America is the place where there's real possibility of that taking place. The Catholic dominance is still extremely powerful. So there you get, I believe, what's happening in the Roman Catholic dialogue. And as I said, this is no intellectual game. This is dead serious. Because the church is there, millions of Latin Americans are Catholics, the turbulence is there, they need a social interpretation, they believe they've got it in Marxism, they believe Marxism can fit with Christianity, and they're seriously working out this synthesis of Marxism and Christian revelation. Now, just one word of caution. What I'm talking about is a very small segment of the Roman Catholic Church in Latin America. It's an avant-garde, it's a small minority among certain orders. It's certainly by far not the vision of all the Latin American prelates and the people, but it's probably where at least many people would locate the cutting edge of Roman Catholic social thought and social action. Well, why don't I leave it there, Alan?
Do you want to say anything, Mo? Okay,
question, if you took the avant-garde of the Catholic philosophy and implemented it, what would be the implications for a multinational country like the United States? What happens physically?
If the revolution would come off in Latin America, what would happen? Well, I think you'd have some pretty good indications of what would happen: a nationalization of the American companies. Chile had already been moving toward nationalization of American companies, but Allende was going to take it the next step, and national ownership of them, and then in the long run, hopefully. According to the vision, worker ownership and control of these large economic organizations.
But when they do that, they effectively cut off any further capital investment from outside, so that they're then, you know, any foreign exchange increase is cut off. Are they thinking about that in their equation of social change?
Well, I'm sure they think about it because it's happened. And I would suspect, I'd like to have you two respond to that, but I would suspect they're willing to take that risk because they don't see the future as being dependent upon that external capital.
We have seen something similar in the Arab countries with the nationalization of the oil industry. And if I see this correctly, I'm not very much into this, but if I see correctly, what is happening there is that they are just continuing to draw foreign investment. And in fact, they are investing in Western countries a great deal of their superfluous wealth so as to reintegrate their own hopefully blossoming economy with the Western economy. and to tie inflation into inflation. That is, if you know, if we have inflation here, and if our prices get more, if our goods get more expensive, then the oil is going to get more expensive too. For example, 25% of Mercedes-Benz in West Germany was bought last year by Saudi Arabia, I think. They consider Mercedes-Benz, I do too, one of, you know, very solid business which will continue, you know, and so it's a wise decision on their part to buy into that. And
yeah, that's an interesting example, because that's not third world, that's kind of
fourth world. Fourth world now.
And I mean, the really poor Latin American countries don't have that kind of bargaining power.
They're getting about $55 billion American money every year for their own.
Yeah,
it's way more than we ever did in 4 years.
Yes.
Yeah, what the you have to take, I think, Cuba or Tanzania as examples, and they would certainly give us an opportunity to invest our capital at low rates on their terms, but they probably would look to China or to Russia. Or to some other country for help economically in the developed. I would think that's probably the way it would go, because they're more sympathetic and are more likely to get it. I would think most of our capital, if the history in Cuba and other places is any, and Russia is any indication, would simply avoid it like the plague.
Too risky. Has the alienation of the worker, has that been corrected in Russia, for instance?
Oh no, I don't think so.
Maybe in China a little bit, temporarily. But why does this appeal so much to them? They just feel the present, anything is worth trying? Or?
Well, let's not get too philosophical about alienation. In this kind of analysis, alienation means starvation. That is, getting such small wages, say in Latin American peasant or lower class, that you can't keep yourself and your family alive.
So I must say something else, excuse me for disagreeing with you, Bob, but I may be incorrect too. I've been in Russia, you may have been too, but my observation is somewhat different as far as the alienation of the Russian worker is concerned. And again, you know, I've done very little study about this. I'm not a specialist in Marxism, nor do I consider myself a Marxist, but I have seen them identifying their great economic progress in the last 50 years now since the revolution with the Marxistic revolution, obviously. And they have become the second most powerful economic force in the world. It's obvious for them that there is this association. Why shouldn't they have this association? They have come from one of the most backward countries to one of the most advanced countries. They are second only in technology, perhaps first in some of the technologies, to the United States. That certainly can be debated, because there are great loopholes as far as the technology is concerned in the economy. But they are tremendously proud of the achievements. They're tremendously proud of the kind of system that they have. They feel that they each have a share. They are still extremely jealous of the United States position, and they are out to get get out to first place. But what they have achieved up to this point is certainly enviable in such a short time. America and other industrialized countries have had much, much longer a time, have had much a better start. But it was stamped out of nothing, this great economy and this great technology that Russia has, compared to before 1917. So they are tremendously proud of that, and yes, things certainly could be a great deal better, but we must not underestimate the great pride that the modern Russian has in his country.
Yeah, by the way, I'd argue with you a little on that, but it's very important to remember that the Catholic interest in Marxism does not mean that they see Russia as a goal, or Russia as any kind
right.
of incarnation
right.
of their hopes.
Right.
They see that as evil.
That's right.
And their hope is in a socialism that really hasn't been built yet, a humanistic socialism.
They would look more toward China, I think, as at least a thus far a more viable option.
Well, why have the communist societies been such a failure in the area of agriculture, both China and Russia? I've heard statements that if those two large countries were producing enough food that they don't have to import, like Russia, for instance, we wouldn't have the starvation in the world today.
Well, I'm not so sure that's true of China. There's been quite a terrific leap forward, to use their language, in their own agriculture to the point where they're pretty self-sustaining. The unknown factor that is about that is that China is the greatest fertilizer importing nation in the world. So China's done some very interesting things. Russia seems to be a failure for several reasons. One, I believe, is the climatic conditions are very unpredictable. But here's where my free enterprise biases begin to come in. I think that the free enterprise system has worked out most beautifully and most effectively in farming. And if there's anything to hold up in American life as the efficiency and power of the enterprise system, it's farming. And I believe that the kind of planning and public ownership and collective approach in Russia is highly inefficient and not only sacrificing the liberties of people, but inefficient and unproductive. So I'd say those two reasons.
Yes,
a footnote to that on the farming, let's see, the 75, I believe, yearbook of agriculture is really a very interesting thing. Mm-hmm. It's a description of all the work that's gone on in the experiment stations in this country. And in our discussions about energy, I think the funding that's gone into by the government in terms of developing the super wheat and the rice and the corn and so on, there's a lot of money has gone into that in a concentrated effort to improve our production. So there's a lot of technology developed. And this kind of thing, this success, largely comes not only from, I think, private enterprise, but some very great stimulus from the government in terms of that. And I think that's a footnote we ought to think about in terms of appropriate action for government in some of these other areas.
Yeah. Many farm economists say that that's important, the federal intervention in terms of new hybrids and so on, but that by far the most important element in the revolution is the mechanization that's taken place through, again, private enterprises, the huge farm machinery corporations.
Yeah, but it isn't innovation. The mechanization. The Russians have the possibility of mechanization. It's a long history. I just finished reading a chapter by a Marxist on it, his interpretation is that there just was a series of mistakes in calculation about what can be done with people in Russia, and the pressure was just put on, and they just slaughtered their animals, millions of them, and they've never really recovered because there was such resistance. And
the forced collectivism.
Forced collectivism, and furthermore, according to him, they tried to take too much out. That is, according to this Marxian economist, Ernst Mandel, French Marxist, they thought somehow that they had to get all the money for their capital investment in industry out of agriculture, and his theory is there's a limit to what you can do, and they just tried to do it too fast. And that is never, they've never really overcome the resistance on the part of the farmers that developed at that time. That is it. And so since they were not offering advances in standard of living to the farmers because they were taking so much out, they got this resistance. Then in order to try to get the production, they used coercion.
And later they used incentives.
And then they had to move back very rapidly from that toward private land and permitting each person to have a certain percentage of his land.
And what's fascinating is the percentage of their agricultural production that comes from those little private plots. Mm-hmm. I think a quarter of it.
So that I think it's a very complex development in Russia in which there were just some real miscalculations about what human nature is like and how far you can go. Now, according to this Marxist, it's possible to, and it is necessary in any economic development, to have an increasing standard of living for the workers, because that is what you're saying your system is going to do. And it's possible to do that, and he has a long argument about that. So that I think I don't know whether it's inherent in the Marxism or it was the kind of judgment and leadership that was made.
Historically, perhaps also another footnote could be made to expand Bob's point a little bit more. I thought that you were going to say this with this whole setup of the heretical church. We must understand, at least that's the way I was led to understand, that this great advance that has come about in Russia in the last 50 years was possible only by the replacement of a very strict, centralized government. In the Politburo replaced the Tsarist centralized government. Without that, the Russian, who was not used to anything else for centuries, could not possibly be motivated to do something else. And this is, in fact, what Lenin had achieved. So, a new form of repressive government that snapped the whip and started a new kind of program was instituted with all kinds of 5-year plans, which were probably a great deal, you know, very, very unrealistic as far as the ability of the country to, in effect, provide that kind of new progress which they had envisioned.
I think one has to admit that in China they have been able to lick the problem of agriculture. Very intensive work, but they've been able to do it.
I'm interested in what some of you think about this interpretation of the United States' relation to Latin America. Does it make you angry? Does it persuade you? Do you say it's bunk? You get hit with this interpretation by third world people. You don't have to look very far. And I'll hit you in the nose with that. And I'm just wondering how you respond to that.
I don't think it leads anywhere for them.
Say a little bit more.
Well, what are their objectives? I've understood that one of the major problems in Latin America has been land reform. You know, you got the ownership is concentrated in a very small population, which is that oppresses a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So, that maybe by itself is a goal. But as far as total populace increasing their standard of living, redistributing the wealth that the nation has isn't going to help them an awful lot because they don't have that much to begin with. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, everybody gets a nickel, and so they got a nickel more. And it seems to me, you know, if you use the model of us, of Russia, and Japan, and Western Europe, you're looking at industrialization. And so, for them to country by country, try to take on the United States, it's going to only make their oppression worse because they'll cut off our capital investment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically by the increased technology of agriculture and so on, that the standard of living in almost every country has increased.
Mm-hmm. So China exceptions. China didn't have any external wealth. They were able to take their nation, turn it around, and develop the bomb, all kinds of things. And I think South America, Marxists are looking to China and to the kind of thing that happened in China is a possibility for them.
Yeah, but you got a different work ethic in China than you got in Latin America, as I understand.
I don't know. I just don't.
I think that's a key question.
The cultural traditions are really very different.
Best example I can think of, and the only one I really got, is Prelis Buck's The Good Earth, and you know, it seemed like all they were doing there was working. In Latin America, well, my impression is, you know, it's not as aggressive an environment.
I find this interpretation fairly persuasive, having spent a year trying to think about what happened in Chile and why it happened, and our role in Chile, and the role of the CIA and the multinational corporations, and the support of the elites in Chile, and our refusal to give loans, and all kinds of things, and our power in the world, the financial circles to cut off Allende's credit and so forth, our refusal to supply parts for the machines that we had sold them before, this whole story. And I'm not an expert either. We did enough research so that...
But in Chile, what happened? They expropriated Anaconda's Chicoconada and Kennecott's holdings, and Crown Dollarback still owned stuff in Chile, and it wasn't expropriated. We were concerned, but it wasn't. You know, it was a political thing. Anaconda had oppressed that thing for, you know, and they basically milked it for years and years and years, so that, you know, they were fat cats and they got stuck. But I don't think that, as my understanding of talking to guys in Chile, that that occurred for everything. Now, maybe our company was just an exception, I don't really know.
No, it didn't occur for everything, but it seemed to me that the fall of Allende in large part was due to the fact that North American capitalists and the ruling class in Chile combined in order to destroy that regime.
And the labor unions.
Yeah, that's where the debate is whether it was the large part or a sufficient part to tip it.
You know, I think there's a lot of interesting data that comes out, not only the Senate committee, but other research that's done. I mean, Allende was moving in certain ways that alienated great parts of the Chilean
people. That's
right.
Not only the top, but there was, a group of the middle class. Yeah, there was a larger class than just the elite.
That's right.
But the question is whether they could have survived or would have survived if they had a little support. I don't know why Russia and China didn't provide them with the economic support. It's a mystery.
They did. I mean, they funneled.
Not a great deal. According to one of my interpreters who teaches Russian at the University of Russian History at the University of Chicago, there was a deal between the United States and Russia not to intervene in terms of wheat supply for Russia. Now, that may be a kind of, a very far-fetched interpretation. That was his interpretation. Because I was very much amazed that they didn't come to the economic support of the Chilean regime.
Yeah. Is there anything that we can do to alleviate the starvation?
Well, I think a lot of what our obligation is to be much more alert politically. Certainly the food to Latin America, that's a part of the church's mission, you know, without any strings attached. But I think the political question is much more serious. I believe that it's in the self-interest of the United States and of the transnational corporations to be a lot wiser in Latin America. Some of the things that you were saying, that is, if they don't, if they try to control the political life of the country, they're going to get stomped on, but stomped on good when change comes. I would think that it's very important for the United States to get its CIA out of the politics of those countries, and for companies to see that in the long run, sharing the profits with those countries is extremely important, and that if they try to milk those countries white, they're going to get it. That's just the nature of human nature. So I think on several fronts, those the changes in the American perceptions are very important. Or Latin America is either going to wind up a fascist military dictatorship all the way across the line, or it's going to be left-wing dictatorships all across the line. And,
you know, I think there's a bit of a scapegoat type operation going on here. To blame everything on multinational corporations that has happened in generations and generations is a bit harsh, I think, because the multinational corporation is not really that many years old, is it? I mean, are we talking 30 years since World War II, or maybe?
One would never blame the multinational corporations. One would blame the industrial, military, governmental complex in the United States that sees its interests. Not blame completely, see, because you got the whole structure of each country down there. But the governmental military.
But since when? I mean, 1900?
We've trained all the people, the military police that are now doing the interrogation. We trained them. We brought their leaders to the United States, and they are trained at our military establishments. I think it's very clear that we did that.
Yeah,
I mean, there's no doubt about that kind of thing.
But I don't think it's a political doctrination that the United States trains.
Maybe a lot of this started with the Mexican conquistadors and the land development, the way the ownership developed, like, you know, huge blocks of land owned by one person, and it's just kind of perpetuated.
That's right. And I think we're trying to shift the focus here. I think the country, many of the countries,
the seeds of today were planted generations ago, and now we're trying to shift the focus to say, well, the United States is bleeding them all white, and they're the cause of today's effects.
Well, we're not the cause, but the forces we support are the forces of oppression and of maintaining the system in those countries which would fit in with the Marxist analysis. That's all. We're not the cause. But our ideology and our interests, our economic, political, military interests,
isn't helping them resolve the problem.
Are identified with the ruling forces, I think. It's the same way in Spain. We identified with the fascist, the Franco, with the ruling forces. We want our bases. I it makes sense from a military point of view. But I think it's our undoing. I think we have identified ourselves with forces that ultimately will be destroyed by one way or another. And we somehow have not been able to do that. And we did the same thing in China, did the same thing in Vietnam. We seem to, for one reason or another, buck what seems to be a direction and cause it to go further to the left than it need go.
Well, it's partly the people. We didn't do that in Japan. We defeated Japan, but they had an history of their own. They had a social system that was set up, and that MacArthur essentially set Japan back on its feet. Germany was the same thing. Germany recovered after World War II very, very comfortable. Well, I'm comfortably. It's certainly not comfortable when your nation's cut in half. But they rose from ruins. France recovered from devastation. I think we get back to the work ethic, perhaps, to some degree. And it's the way it's been for generations. And whether we stay there or leave, it would probably be that way anyway.
The reason why we failed in Vietnam and succeeded in Germany, for example, is and China and Japan is because in Vietnam there was no industrialization.
Yes.
And the reason why East Germany has been such a miracle, this perhaps should also be pointed out, East Germany is in some ways the major supplier of Russian industrial machinery. The only reason why they can do that is because they had been industrialized.
Oh, tremendous cultural traditions.
Sure. And they get very little in return. In many ways, the rebuilding of the East German economy was far more miraculous than the West German economy. We must also see that, because they have always provided for the Russians and they have never gotten anything back. That's overstating it. They have gotten some things back, but they have always provided, and they don't like it too much. But they have these long term 5 and 10 year contracts. You see, they can't get out of that system. But the mistake that we have made in all post World War II international politics, as far as I can see, is that we assumed that things might work out in Vietnam, for example, and in other parts of the world, as they have worked out in West Germany, to state the most outstanding example. But it can't work in Vietnam. It could never work there because there was no industry there. And we have therefore always had a blind spot. China works very differently, and Russia works very differently too, I think, in their international politics. It seems to me that they are much more flexible to let nations, probably China much more so than Russia even, but they let them have much more of their own feeling. I'm very impressed by the Russian Foreign Service. The people are much more capable of adjusting. You don't see in Russian embassies also many Russians, as you see in American foreign embassy also many Americans. Their educational training, when the Russians are trained at the university, they are trained from the very earliest start to specialize, and they speak the language fluently, the languages of other countries.
They have a strong compound mentality, though. That's
right.
I mean, they stick
together.
Yeah.
But they are much more. They have much greater sensitivity, I think, than we do. And I would say that this is true of Europeans generally. This is true, I think, in Germany, for example. German foreign policy, I think all of European foreign policy is much more flexible than the American foreign policy has been, and this is, I think, related to the American idea of manifest destiny, that we must get everybody around, you know, to our way of life. And
I'd like to get back to the problem of, let's focus on South America. What have we got to offer South America as a way of dealing with a great proletariat that is poor, uneducated, disease-ridden, just millions and millions of people and an increasing population? There's what interpretation do we have to offer that would provide them with some hope and some alternative to the Marxian interpretation? I think that's the real issue. What's the possibility for those, for people who are on the bottom in those countries?
Well, I think we do have to turn over our capital investment. I mean, I think what was stated earlier, we have to let their people take over the industry that we've developed. I mean, it just doesn't any other way.
But who takes it over?
I think Brazil is a very good example. There's been a tremendous increase in foreign capital investment in Brazil in the last few years through World Bank and through loans from other countries and so on. And a key thing, I mentioned South Vietnam, I think it's real key. We destroyed the only real stable government there in the Diem regime. And the stability of governments, I think, is key to any industrialization. And so if they get a stable government, like Brazil, there's confidence being restored in Brazil because the government has maintained, even though they got inflation rates unbelievable, people learn to cope with it, and the investment is increasing there. So that, you know, that is an example of something that is being strengthened, that the country is getting investment in there on terms some like Ian's talking about.
According to my figures, however, the Green Revolution in Brazil created unemployment and lower wages. And the money goes to the hands of the big landowners who have the capital, bring in the equipment, get rid of the laborers, and sell their goods on the market, and particularly foreign market, and make more money, and therefore more capital. But the plight of the worker gets worse.
Well, it has to probably be tied to land reform in some way, and that's why I don't think you can deal with the economic question until, you know, of the capital investment, until you deal prior with the political question of who's to be in control. I guess that's what you were asking, who's going to control the capital investment?
For whose benefit?
But then we can't get involved as a country in determining what kind of government.
Yeah, but that's what we're precisely doing. That's the problem. We're propping up.
There's a tremendous amount of pressure to keep the
situation. We have been involved all over the world.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought maybe, well, since Allende, I thought perhaps...
I don't think there's any way to avoid being involved when you've got a world economic system and when the money market is so important, yeah, and you control or are very influential in the money market, and you have the technology and you have all these things that are needed. You have the credits that are necessary for the development. I think it's very difficult for a nation to step back and just say, well, our policy will be to be neutral. I think that's the myth that we have had.
But, you know, there have been instances in Latin American history where we have been rather wise. I think we did support the Eduardo Frei development in Chile, which was a democratic government and moving toward reform. And it's a tragedy that movement petered out or lost its momentum. But it would seem to me it'd be those kind of groups that we should be supporting politically, that who are for reform but don't have this apocalyptic vision in mind that there's going to be this great polarization because the polarization really does happen. That's the problem.
Well, when you talk about support, what do you mean by support?
Well, I'm not naive enough to believe that we won't put in money there clandestinely and so on. We probably will support those political parties of the middle, or we should support those political parties of the middle in some ways.
You know, it's getting to be, companies are starting to put out statements of ethics for this company, you know, because of the IPT business and the antitrust. Things are getting more and more difficult to even interpret. And so it's becoming, it's as I view it anyway, in corporate life, you're inviting jail sentence to, or at least severe censure to play the game the way it's been played in the past. Now I think there's going to be a real adjustment in terms of who does what.
Yeah, well, I don't think transnational corporations have any business being involved politically. You know,
but
I'm talking
interest.
More about the foreign policy of our country, the State Department.
What influences that? You know, the multinationals are certainly talking to somebody.
Well, I would hope that the political control is heavier than the economic interests.
When you hear of industries paying hundreds of thousands of dollars to do business in a country, just to sell their airplane or Boeing or wants to sell a 747 or whatever, and you have to bribe people to go through the mechanism of just market